You're listening to the NAGRA Podcasters Network. From Port Colborne to Port Dalhousie, from the raging rapids of the Niagara River to Niagara's Gateway in Grimsby, from Fort Erie to Fort George and all the points in between, you're listening to The Regional, a Niagara news magazine from the Niagara Podcasters Network. It's Saturday, January 27th, 2018. You're listening to The Regional, Niagara's news magazine on the Niagara Podcasters Network. I'm Trevor Twining, I'm the host, and I am joined by Robin McPherson from Janice and Robin.
Thank you, Trevor. Happy to be here.
And Melinda Cheevers from Niagara This Week. Thanks for coming back, Melinda. It's been a while. It's really good to have you back.
Thank you. I'm happy to be on the first show of 2018.
Yes. And Sean Polden, Principal Consultant at Polden Consulting Group. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Trevor.
Sean, is this your first time joining us?
This is my first time on The Regional. I'm pretty excited.
It's awesome to have you here. We have changed the format in 2018 from what we were doing in 2017. In 2017, we had some folks who were picking the stories. Truth be told, it was largely me. But the guests are going to start picking the stories, and we started doing that process with you. And so we're basically going to go around the table. You guys are going to introduce the stories and why you thought it was important to talk about, and then we're going to talk about it as a group. So, Melinda, let's start with you today.
All right. So I have a story that was put up on January 26th by my coworker, Paul Forsyth, about Niagara's economic momentum being the second strongest in Canada. So essentially, he writes that the housing market is what helped get Niagara to the second spot, that the National Bank of Canada released a Metropolitan Economic Momentum Index study where they analyzed six different factors that resulted in the rankings for the cities or areas. So in Niagara, it was the new home builds, the price of the housing market, house sales that helped propel it to that spot. I wanted to talk about it today because I thought it was kind of interesting. People that live in Niagara know that the economy here isn't perhaps as great as it should be, that there's a need for some more employment opportunities and perhaps some better paying employment opportunities. And touting these results as us having the, you know, the second strongest economic momentum in Canada, while it may make for great headlines, it might not be an overly realistic picture for people that live here, I don't think. And I just wanted to see what other people around the table thought.
Sean, when you have these sorts of situations when one particular industry sort of changes the numbers for the, you know, for this type of scenario, how does it impact, you know, the stories that we tell locally?
Well, I think that we question the sustainability of that. You know, when you look at the real estate market in Southern Ontario as a whole, the increase that we've seen in Niagara has largely been driven because of the Toronto market and the increases that we've seen here. However, I don't think it's strictly residential construction that's taking place. The other day at the, I didn't attend this, but I followed the coverage of the cannabis forum that was held at Niagara College. And there, Blake Landry, who's the with the Niagara Region's Economic Development Department, brought up the point that over the last couple of years, $100 million have been invested in greenhouse infrastructure related to the cannabis industry. And he predicts over the next couple of years that there's another $100 million that's being added to that. With that type of development also comes jobs with that, because obviously people are going to need to work in those greenhouses, and you know, there's logistics and you know, obviously education as you train the people that are going to lead these types of organizations. So I think we have to focus not necessarily on those you know, residential growth opportunities, but like look at what those you know, commercial opportunities and how we're leveraging those currently.
And to be fair, one of the six key economic indicators did include non-residential building construction as well.
Yeah. So.
Robin, what say you?
I mean, when I was reading the story and looking at it, I thought the one thing that has been discussed as an issue is the cost of, you know, the resulting increases in residential housing for residents that live here. And a lot of people, I mean, I grew up in Fond Hill, and there would be no way that most people could afford, for example, to live in Fond Hill now as compared to 10, you know, 15, 20 years ago. And I think that there's a concern, at least I see a concern, of ensuring that the people who live here and are working here are able to still afford housing here. And a lot of people are getting priced right out of the market. So you can't, you're having to either choose to stay in a smaller house with a growing family and because you're not able to afford the next level. So I think that would be a concern specifically when it comes to residential.
The other piece of this is like the actual management of this growth from like a policy perspective. With this increase, you have, you know, all of these new building permits that need to be approved, all of these, you know, subdivision plans that need to be gone over. Our planning, city planning and regional planning functions, have they grown over the last little bit to accommodate this increase? So that leads me to the question, you know, are these developments all, you know, I guess meeting what the community's objectives for growth are? I was earlier this morning, I was at an event in Waynefleet where they were, deeply concerned about the urbanization of what they consider their rural community. There's one particular development that they're talking about that's I think is about 40 some units that's being built on Lake Erie. And they're concerned about the precedent that's setting. And will that lead to more similar developments, which will then in turn lead to the demanding of urbanized services such as, water and sewers, which they had talked about, you know, maybe 8, 9, 10 years ago or so in those communities, and people were getting quotes of upwards of $78,000 in order to bring sewer to their front door. Well, they've never needed that before. The reason that they need that now is because of this development pressure. It's that those types of discussions that I think we need to be having during this construction boom, because those are the discussions that are going to have those longer impacts on our communities that quite frankly, the development community doesn't care about.
Don't we have an infrastructure deficit? I mean, as a region St. Catharines is a city or the region, aren't we significantly behind in investing in our infrastructure?
Well, it's a story that we've heard time and again from our leaders in those positions that we need to catch up and invest, and that we need funds from the other levels of government, provincial and federal, in order to catch up with that. So I would expect that is still the case.
So from a development point of view or growth point of view, do we even have the things needed in place to grow and continue to grow?
Well, I mean, maybe these studies that come out can be used now by those politicians and by the different levels of government to go and lobby for that. I mean, in a Royal LePage report that came out, it showed that the average price of a bungalow in Niagara rose 23.5% over the same period the previous year. The price of a two-story home jumped 23.4%. And that's the second highest price increase among the 53 markets nationwide. So when you take that and you're saying we're having the second largest growth in the nation, we need help now to accommodate for that. And hopefully that's what they'll be doing, is lobbying with these data and the stats that are there to help prove the need.
Sean, let's go with you next. What's your story?
So on Thursday night, the A Better Niagara Group, which I'm the executive director of, hosted our first of what's going to be a series of candidate campaign info sessions. A Better Niagara is a newly a new nonprofit organization. Our mandate is to encourage civic engagement and municipal political partisan. Participation. It was very well attended. We had probably close to 40 people out. Our guest speakers were Debbie Zimmerman and Eleanor Lancaster, two longtime local municipal political figures in the region. And we essentially went over what an individual needs to look at in their personal situation to make that decision as to whether running for council is the right decision for them. 2018 is an election year. There's a lot of people that are concerned and interested in what's going on in their community. So we're going to see a lot of people coming forward and presenting ideas as to how to make their communities better. And we really see ourselves as a tool that these people can use to enable them to run effective campaigns.
The one thing that I liked about, so I saw the coverage of this event on Kojiko's program, and the one thing that I liked that I got from that was that one of the things that you were communicating through that is the amount of time that was spent or that a candidate needs to spend both in the election and, you know, in their role as counselor, because a lot of people, I think, underestimate how much effort and time is required for that. In your opinion, Sean, where are the other areas that people, I guess, underestimate the level of involvement or things that they don't think about when they're stepping into the political ring?
So there's in an election campaign, there's three main inputs. You have the candidate's time, which we've discussed is quite significant. We have financial resources. You need money to build a website and put that up, to produce flyers, to do telephone polling. All of these are essential in communicating your message out to the public. And then the third aspect is volunteer resources and who's the community support that's behind you to propel you forward. With those three things, they're extremely interconnected. So, in so much that, perhaps you don't have a lot of personal time. Well, you can compensate for that by having a large number of supporters and influencers behind you and some financial resources, that can, broadcast your message. If you don't have necessarily the financial base for a large campaign, you can make that up by spending a lot of your time and having a large crew behind you. If you don't have that large crew to go out there and drop off flyers, you can compensate for that by, hiring Canada Post to deliver your brochures for you. That's the type of thing that we prepare people for an election and really give people show people what they need to look at in their personal situations to make that decision to run.
Melinda, in your experience, what do you wish candidates knew about relating to the media going into their campaigns? If you could tell people one way to work with you better, right? Like, what would that be?
From a media perspective, it's always covering elections are interesting. We always try to do fair balance. So in any area, if you have, let's break it down by ward. So we try to give each ward candidate the same amount of coverage, to the point where we try to lay it out in in similar spots in the paper. We try to have the same amount, like the same length of story, run the photo around the same size, so that there's no perception of you know, benefit being given to one candidate over the other. So I think that when it comes to election, it gets hard because there are some candidates that are going out to 50 different community events and they're contacting us about those 50 different community events and want us to come out to all of them. We can't. you can't just because, A, there's a lot of other things going on in the community that we have to cover. And B, we, you know, can't give so much coverage to one candidate as opposed to others without being fair. So I think that's hard, is the expectation is a lot of candidates reach out to us to try to get free promotion, free coverage, and we have to maintain a fair and balanced approach. And we can't spend the whole time leading up to a campaign just covering candidates being out at events. So I think that they try to use us as a tool to reach out to those people, like to get their name out there, to reach out to voters. But I think that there's other ways to do that by going to the events and meeting the people firsthand. But yeah.
Robin, you participate on the Heritage Committee for the City of St. Catharines, is that correct?
Yes, and, as well as a few others.
Yeah, and so you have, and you've been doing that for quite some time,
a long
as
time.
A volunteer, right?
Yes, so, as a volunteer.
So to what extent, what do you want potential candidates to know about the various committees and how to work with them in their role as councillor?
I think it's committees. I think a lot of city committees for, you know, people running or even current councillors are a bit of a mystery, that there are some councillors who are very active and then there are others that are not. And I think that council, it would be great, in my opinion, if councillors really took the time to, if you're running, to most, I mean, all the city committees are open to the public. So to have people who are running attend some of those meetings, just to get a sense of, you know, the what the committee is, what it does, and then even talk to the committee members, because I think on the several committees I sit on, there are a lot of great ideas and there are a lot of great volunteers who are trying to contribute in their way back to the community. And I think councillors could learn, and candidates could learn quite a bit from them, and that they're there to support what's going on. They're not these little rogue committees trying to come up with stuff. They're, you know, trying to work with council and work with the community to balance out and provide council that feedback.
Sean, the most recent event was in St. Catharines. There are more events coming up, though. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. So we have one on January 31st in Niagara Falls. That one was sold out until I arranged for a larger space within the same building. So we just opened up some more tickets to that one. On February 3rd, we have one at Welland City Hall in their Civic Center between 1 and 2:30 in the afternoon. They're 90-minute sessions. We go over two little quick little workshops that, you know, the first one is the more of the, you know, regulations around running to make sure that you're eligible. The second one is the self-assessment. And then we follow that up with a perspective from somebody who has previously run, you know, what campaign is life, campaign life is like. And then the second piece of that is the counselor perspective, what it's like to actually govern.
Very cool. And we will put the links to those upcoming events in the show notes. So
thank you.
You're listening to The Regional, a Niagara Region news magazine produced by the Niagara Podcasters Network. 2018 marks more than a few changes for The Regional. Among them, we're aiming to bring new local music your way every episode. Our inaugural attempt at this highlights local electronic musician Erie Lake. His first release, Mountain Hare, is a hypnotic, captivating melody. I'm eager to hear more work from artist DJ Benison. Here's Mountain Hare on the Regional, Niagara's News Magazine, on the Niagara Podcasters Network. That was Mountain Hare by Niagara electronic musician Erie Lake. You can find more of his work on SoundCloud, and if you have an artist you'd like us to feature on the Regional, you can let us know by sending us an email to niagarapodcasters@gmail.com or on social media at Niagara Podcasts. You are listening to the Niagara Podcasters Network. Robin, we're off to you. What was your story this week?
So my story is a new development that's happening in Meriton, the St. James Anglican Church, which closed, it moved on in 2017, and it's been purchased by a developer who's going to turn it into condos, and so he's going to turn it into 15 units that will range in price from, you know, around $175,000 to $300,000 plus, close to $4,000. But to me, what's exciting about it is the repurposing of a heritage building that we have. There's lots of many churches right now specifically that have closed across the city, across the region. Some of them have been purchased by other churches. In the case of Welland Avenue United Church, it was purchased by Community Living, and they have done an amazing job and are continuing to do an amazing job to repurpose the building. And it's exciting to see somebody turn it into a development. The church conversions have been quite popular in other cities. Toronto's done quite a few. And it's just really nice to see somebody thinking differently and trying something different with a heritage building, because we have a lot of them.
It's true. And I mean, the church buildings in particular, they typically have like really good architecture.
Beautiful.
And they're well constructed. And
yes.
So those buildings are going to last for, you know, for a long time because they were well funded when they were constructed. Right. So And they tended not to cut corners, possibly for fear of repercussions in the afterlife. We don't know. But
vengeful gods, yes.
Possibly. They're going to work with the existing structure.
Working with the existing structure. They're trying to... The exterior of the building, according to the story, will remain almost the same. I believe they're adding a little rooftop terrace. So the conversion will happen inside. They have the goal of... Which is actually what Community Living did with Welland Avenue, is they're utilizing pieces of the church inside, whether it be pews or stained glass windows, to maintain and incorporate those into the building. It's the greenest building is one that's already built. So the fact that they're trying to incorporate these elements is, I think, going to lead to something quite stunning.
Melinda, what do you think?
I'm really excited about this. Robin and I were talking about it a little bit before we went on air. When I lived in Brantford, one of my classmates had an apartment in a church that had been repurposed. And it was, to this day, one of the coolest apartments I've ever seen. It had really high ceilings, interesting angles everywhere, these giant, glorious sun letting in windows because they had crafted it out of the space that was there. So, she was on the second floor, but the ceilings just went on forever and interesting angles. And I think that we have a lack of interesting options when it comes to condos here in Niagara. There's a lot of new builds or conversion of old apartment buildings into condominiums, which, architecturally, they're not the most interesting spaces. So I'm excited about this idea. I know you had mentioned other cities. In Buffalo, they have a lot of old warehouses that have been converted, made into condominiums, and they retain a lot of the unique features. They also have this one in Buffalo that's like an old schoolhouse, and they converted it into like an old school building. And they converted it and left some of those neat aspects, such as the chalkboards in the condo spaces. So you walk into this giant living room where there's cool chalkboards, or the really low hooks for children. Just interesting aspects to add to a space. And I'm excited. I mean, I'm not going to be able to afford to buy one of them, but just knowing that they exist here in the city is enough for me, I think.
Sean, what about you?
When it comes to the adapted reuse of buildings like this, I think like there really needs to be a lot of community planning around the ultimate end structure, I guess. With these churches for the last, however many years, 50, 7500 years or whatever it is, they've been community spaces. From a planning perspective, what happens when we remove that space from public use and recommission it for private use? I think when you look at the neighborhood around this particular development, there's a lot of public space in that. So this development in particular, I think it's probably a really good fit. If we start looking around other places in the city, particularly when we as we become a more dense community, losing those community spaces is going to be more difficult to swallow because we only have so many left. I think long-term thinking, long-term planning really needs to play a pivotal role in what the future of these buildings are going to be. Because I think, as these church congregations get older and whether or not they adapt to the trends of parishioners is really going to be a good indication as to whether or not they can keep going. But if these spaces are going to be eventually passed on, what voids are those going to leave in our communities when it comes to public spaces?
I know in some areas, like I recently went to Queenston for a community meeting there, and there was a really interesting presentation, the Queenston area, sorry, not Queenston, the community. And there was a really interesting presentation by a group of young students from Connaught. I think they were all in grade 5, and they were pushing for a community center because there is that lack of public gathering space within that community, or so they felt. And one of the interesting things that the principal of the school told me when I asked, you know, why did they host it at an elementary school, was that she said that that school has filled the function of a community gathering space. That parents were renting it out for birthday parties, renting it out for baby showers, the gym and the classrooms. And I would have never thought to do that. But I find that people adapt and find ways to etch out that public space that they still need.
I tend to take it very much at a heritage building level. And I think the issue that we've had a significant problem with in Niagara is that it seems to me that it's more of a, it's less of a choice of adapting these buildings and reusing them. And it's been common practice or generally the practice to tear the building down. And that has been how we think about older buildings at this point. I'm not sure about the lack of, I'm not sure it's a community space if you don't have a church there. Like if the church is essentially, you know, gathering in another location, you know, I think there's that. But to me, it's that we have to start thinking differently about adaptive reuse of buildings that we have. I mean, like Melinda said, like you go to other cities and you see how they're adapting factory buildings and they're adapting, you know, unusual spaces. And I think we've had a general lack of vision and desire to be different or kind of thinking outside the box when it comes to the buildings. I mean, you drive through Hamilton and you see what people are doing there. And I think the community does kind of figure it out. We certainly need to have community space, but I think when it comes to buildings that are mostly what's happening with them is they get shuttered and they get closed and they get left to rot. They
become derelict.
Yeah, they become derelict and then It's, you know, demolition by neglect. And you know, you can see that in certain places in the city. And I think that that's to have somebody, you know, there have been some great developments downtown, revitalization of buildings downtown that were in horrible condition, and now they hold some really great, you know, some great businesses are in those locations and they're expanding. So I think we just have to have people who are willing to kind of take the chance on these kind of buildings. And I mean, I do think planning certainly, most certainly, and building codes and inspections have to keep up with the idea that you are working on a building that has some heritage value and has some, and that there has to be some flexibility to it. Because that's another issue that a lot of older buildings are running into, that they're running into people in planning departments who won't see that it can be done differently or that there are ways to adapt and still maintain the really amazing character of the buildings.
And perhaps, you know, bringing it back to that community space and these old buildings, with the accessibility laws that are coming in, we see this with the struggles that the BME church is facing. Mm-hmm. They need what, $500,000 over the next
at least
5 years or so in order to just meet accessibility standards, right? So if we're talking about community spaces, maybe that's a fair point. You know, maybe some of these old buildings aren't meant to be, you know, public community spaces because they just don't meet those demands anymore. Yeah. And that could be a very good point, but you still need that, you know, that overall planning to make sure that we have those community spaces.
And I think planning is the key thing here. There are some new builds that are on the horizon. I won't mention their names because some of them are pretty contentious, but there is community space built into those designs as well that would then put in space that is open and available. And I think that if planning at whatever level works with those developers in the future to kind of build that in more cases, that would be an interesting idea. Or even there is like a push from the government to have more, the provincial government to have more community hubs to go in to, like, you know, when a school closes, to look at the idea of creating community hubs out of those spaces. That's another, I guess, idea within the realm of this.
Well, and a great example of that is the Greek community center in the north end of St. Catharines. They've done a fantastic job with that school. So,
and a really bad example is Parliament Oaks. That's another topic altogether, though.
Mm-hmm. It's a yes. Yes.
But to go into Niagara on the Lake, another good example is the former Virgil Public School. So that has been bought by a developer, but the developer, you know, they live in the community. They haven't started building or doing anything within that building. So the old schoolhouse that a lot of people wanted to have maintained because they thought there was heritage value in it, although that ended up being something a little bit different than what people thought, they are using that now. There was an aerial dance studio in there. There is a group that are repairing and restoring bikes for migrant workers working out of there. There are the air cadets were practicing out of there. Different groups were renting rooms. So they are reusing that space for a community purpose. Lots of people take their dogs for walks in the park.
Mm-hmm. I think as well that as residents and you know, coming up on an election year and silly season or whatever you want to call it, is that as residents, instead of, I think that a lot of times what happens with new developments is everybody kind of gets that their backup immediately of, I don't want things to change. So instead of it being a conversation, and I, you know, their developers have these same, you know, developers are coming in from out of town and will kind of try to impose their vision, is that if somehow the planning departments or the cities where the developments are happening, if they took perhaps a stronger role in trying to keep the conversation moving forward as opposed to it becoming this festering, angry moment of not naming names of locations or anything.
I've sat through way too many public meetings in way too many municipalities to have any idea that it couldn't turn into a festering, angry
That's
mold
true.
Of NIMBYs.
That's true. Okay, never mind.
I did not expect that the longest and most involved conversation that we were going to have today was going to be around the whole idea of planning. And so, but it really is one of the most important functions that that a municipal government does. And given the election and all the things that we're talking about, it I think ultimately it does make sense. So I hope this actually inspires people who are interested in, you know, working through these kinds of issues, whether it's from a development standpoint or from a heritage or a cultural standpoint, or a standpoint of making sure that the community has what it needs. If these are the conversations that you want to have, this is why you should get involved. This was a great introduction into 2018 for the regional. Sean Polden, Melinda Cheevers, and Robin McPherson, thank you all very much for joining us on our first episode. And I look forward to having you all back at some point in the next couple of months.
All right. I'll be there.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Regional Niagara's News Magazine on the Niagara Podcasters Network. I'm Trevor Twining. Have yourself a great week, and we'll see you next week. Thanks for listening to the Regional Niagara's News Magazine on Niagara Podcasters Network. The executive producer is Trevor Twining. The music is by Scott Holmes, used with permission. If you have an idea for a story for the regional, you can reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at Niagara Podcasts, or you can send us an email at niagarapodcasters@gmail.com.